I'm Matt Booker.
I'm Dave Laird.
I'm Adam Levin, and Slocum Dice Friday, here on Concavity Show.
Adam Levin, welcome back to Concavity Show. This is episode 77, and this is your third appearance hanging out with us.
It is.
Great to have you back, man.
Thank you, Matt.
We have you on for a very specific and celebratory occasion, which is that your first novel, The Instructions, which came out 13 years ago, I believe. Is that right?
Yes.
Is getting a new edition from McSweeney's very soon here, coming out, is it May 21st, I believe?
Yep.
Called the Bar Mitzvah Edition. So that's on brand for the amount of time it's been out for, huh?
Yep. Exactly.
So congrats on that.
But yeah, yeah.
And was that your idea or their idea?
It was a combo. It was kind of mine. I said it sort of jokingly.
Yeah.
And they ran with it. And then I, you know, doubted it like I doubt every other choice I make. But then I was like, no, it's good. Yeah. You want to be cute. It is, it's Bar Mitzvah, so, you know.
So I have to admit, I have not yet seen the physical artifact of the Bar Mitzvah edition.
But I think they're like in the mail to us right now. Raj from McSweeney was kind enough to send them to us, but they haven't quite landed yet. I know there's some delays.
I wanted to ask, though, I assume that it's divided up where volume one is like the Side of Damage, and then volume two is the Gurionic War and the Coda. Is that right?
Exactly.
Seems about an even break.
Yes, yes. The code is with volume two. Yeah.
It seems like it is. It's almost a natural break between, I mean, it is a natural break, but it seems like almost equal amounts of two volumes, each of which would be a serious, hefty novel for any other writer.
500-ish,
In one volume. But I wanted to ask you if you had a bar mitzvah, and if you could talk about the purpose of a bar mitzvah in general.
Sure. I did have a bar mitzvah. The purpose, depending kind of how you look at it, it's a coming of age ceremony. It's when you become a man, or for a girl, it's a bat mitzvah when you become a woman. And for males, it's 13. For girls, it's 12. And and what that basically means, that you become a man or a woman, is that if you fuck up after you've turned 13 as a boy, 12 as a girl, it's your fault. You fuck up before then, it's your parents' fault. So it's sort of like the parents are pretty psyched, you know? And
they're off the hook now.
Yeah. And then otherwise, there's also this sort of, I kind of think this ritual humiliation aspect to it, right? Where like you go up, like, I don't mean that, like, I'm like really, like, you go up in front of a whole bunch of people, adults and children, with your busted ass cracking voice, looking extremely awkward like every other person who's 12 or 13.
Acneed.
Yeah. And like you're in front of them, like facing them, and you're reading from the Torah. And if you're, you know, if you're in America and you're not Orthodox, in most cases you're reading a language you actually don't know at all, that you know how to sound out by the letters. Mm-hmm. Usually you learn what it means, and then maybe you give a little speech on it or something. But the main thing is, it's really nerve-wracking, that part. And then afterward, there's a party, you know, depending, you know, sort of where you are and when you are, how intense that party is. You know, it depends. It varies pretty widely. So, yeah.
And what was yours like?
Mine was pretty big. Mine was like, I was definitely bigger than my wedding. it was more in a lot of ways, more of a to-do. Like, I think it was like 180 people.
That's a lot.
A lot of people, man. You know, there was like, it was the 90s. So it's like, I don't know if they do this anymore, but there's a theme, right? Like, you have a theme, everyone has a theme. Like, a lot of people did sports. Mine was like heavy metal, you know.
Oh, dope.
The head
Slayer
table.
Yeah. Banners and stuff.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, like my table, the head table was Led Zeppelin. That's like what I thought. Was, oh. Led Zeppelin's the greatest, you know, and there was a Metallica table and, you know.
Pantera.
Like, and yeah, man. And mine, you know, I was a certain kind of kid. And like, so it was, I had fun. I had a real fun time in mine. Like my, the thing I didn't like at bar mitzvahs, because there's a lot of them at my school, like I lived in this suburb that I think was like 30% Jewish or something. So there's a lot of bar mitzvahs. Mm. And you go there and like, you want to steal the wine, basically. Like you drink the wine and you slow dance with the girls and you eat a lot of dessert if you're a big fat kid like I was. And so like, the thing that was cool was, at mine was, I did what I didn't want to do is dance to anything but slow dances, because I don't know how to dance, and I didn't, and I was shy. And so
like House of Pain comes on, you're fucked, basically.
Yeah. I don't need. And I was like, I don't need that. All that Moni Moni bullshit. Like there was this thing where people would dance to Moni Moni and change the lyrics, you know, like there's group thing, hula hoop contest, limbo, all this shit I could care less about. And so I told the DJ I just wanted it to be slow dances or metal. And he resisted. And then he said, I was like, no, that's what I want. And my mom was like, that's what he wants. Like, and so they made it. He said, I'll do all slow dances and metal. And then at one point, I think it was like, I don't think it was House of Pain, but it was something else. It was something dancey. And I like went up to him. I was like, this isn't metal and this is not a slow dance. It was like,
you took charge and advocated.
He's like a 13-year-old boy is weird, my boss right now. This is
like,
great.
I don't want to do this. Like this, you know, because it's your bar mitzvah, so you kind of have to go and do the dance then. And so it's like this doubly shitty thing, you know.
Did your bar mitzvah predate Guns N' Roses' November Rain?
Yes.
Because that song does double duty on what you're describing.
Yeah, that would have been perfect, man. No, it predated it by a long shot. But no, the slow dances were pretty, they weren't very metally slow dances. There was probably like, you know, they always played like Bon Jovi back then, like the Bon Jovi slows.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I didn't mean to miss your birthday, baby, that kind of garbage. But yeah, I think it was like standard like pop slow dance. Yeah. So.
Yeah, okay. Was your family pretty religious growing up?
No.
When you were a kid?
No. They were, I mean, it was weird. They sent me to, I was at like a conservative synagogue for Hebrew school. And, but yeah, no, they were not.
Okay.
Yeah. Like we celebrated all the high holidays, and we would, you know, we lit candles on Shabbos. Like, I guess like we weren't secular, but like we were medium religious. For our milieu, like there were people that were more religious and people that were less religious.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The sense that I get, like, reading the instructions is that, like, you've obviously got a lot of, like, heavy background in, like, Hebrew studies. So I was curious, like, to what extent that was, like, a formative part of your childhood, or if it was, like, you just did a lot of research, like, later in life, or...
Well, I really, actually, really, most years, I really liked Hebrew school. But yeah. Again, I didn't learn Hebrew. Like, I learned how to read it.
Did you get kicked out of any?
Out of Hebrew school? No. No.
No, okay. So the autobiographical reading of the instructions only goes so far here for us.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, like I did at one point. No, I was going to make some
Messiah dumb, complex?
But... Yeah, yeah. I definitely did have something like that. But yeah, but okay. But yeah, but no, I dug the stories a lot. I really liked Torah stories. I really liked when the rabbis would tell us stuff from Talmud that wasn't in Torah, was, you know, like there's a story like in the instructions about like the fingernails and the first Shabbos, like things like this, like
that's gonna ask about that. Yeah,
yeah, like that. I love that stuff, like because I had some really great teachers in that they were kind of like the perfect teachers for someone like me, which was that they told stories extremely well, and they also would answer like any question, like because I would ask them like crazy, like not like trying to play like stump the rabbi, but there would be like really like, because there's stuff, you know, it's like I remember I asked about Sodom and Gomorrah and like what was going on that was so bad, and they made up some bullshit that was kind of amazing that like actually haunted me worse than if they'd just been like, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, illegal fucking going on, which was like they said they were really bad people to visitors. Like, they were shitty hosts. And I was like, what do you mean shitty hosts? And they didn't say shitty, you know, but they were like, they were terrible.
Like xenophobic.
Yeah. And like, and I was like, what's an example? And I guess, like, I don't know if this is like a common thing that they tell kids who pester them about what goes on in Sodom and Gomorrah, or like, this guy just came up with it on the spot. But the rabbi was like, well, if you came in to stay and to stay the night, they would give you a bed. And if you were too tall for the bed, then while you were sleeping, they would chop your legs off to where you fit the bed. And I was like, that's freaky. He said, and if you were too short for the bed, they would like, and he described this like stretching instrument. This like, they would stretch you out till
like
you...
Like a rack kind of...
Yeah, exactly. It was so scary, man. I had nightmares about the stretching thing a few times. What? Like, it was... Wow. So yeah, so good story.
Like, you're on the bed, you're like the Gregor Samsa
situation.
Wow.
I want to stay with this, though, because I think it does illustrate something interesting about the book, but also interesting to me, which is like this kind of crossover between like secular and religious, or like this gray area you just described, which is like, yeah. You know, I grew up pretty conservative Christian evangelical church going, and like, you could not say the words like Motley Crue, Def Leppard. Like, that was like absolutely panic. Like, if you said you listen to Judas Priest, people would be like, you don't belong in church. You need to be saved. Like, there's something really wrong with you. And so the fact that like your bar mitzvah could be themed where like maybe you even had a Poison or Motley Crue, like Ozzy Osbourne and like Black Sabbath. Like, to me, that was like, we didn't really know what Satanism would be, but it would be Ozzy Osbourne, right? Like, for us, it was like, it was, you know, the band Kiss alone, just the looking at him was like, that's unchristian. And so, you know, what you're describing is like, your parents didn't sound like super, obviously they're not as strict as like Orthodox, you know, like I lived in Crown Heights for a while where like those people are separate and apart, almost like the Amish, right? Hasids, but we also have like Reformed Jewish, which is like, I associate more with just like the Baptists of Christianity, where they like, they go to church and maybe on the high holy days, like sort of like you're describing, but they're not like, and maybe they're more or less political. I mean, there's a political element here I wanted to ask you about as well. Like, the history of political Judaism versus like practicing Judaism. I mean, you kind of describe where you fall in that, but like, can you speak more about like what that felt like to you? Did it feel spiritual at all?
Well, I don't know what spiritual really means. I mean, like, I personally, when I was a kid, I think I sort of believed in God. Like, I think I did. Like, I think like it was like, but what that means to believe in God was, to me, was, I think it was like, I'm not going to pretend, like, I'm going to say that a lot of these stories are real. The stories that seem like they could be real, I'll roll with them and try to see what they all amount to, like how they all add up, and like give it like a very strong benefit of the doubt. Like, be like, this system is interesting. And granted, I'm talking about like when I'm a young kid, so I wasn't thinking exactly in those terms, but it wasn't like I walked around, you know, thinking that God was watching me all the time or something. I very much didn't think that like God could hear my thoughts. I was definitely not someone who believed that after you died, you went to some place, you know, like it was, you know, and I wasn't taught to believe those things. I was taught to believe that that wasn't the case. By, you know, I think by the rabbis as well as by my family. And I mean, you know, when I was a little kid, I think my mom told me some bullshit about the afterlife to make me feel better when I was scared about something, you know,
sure,
but like, So, but I don't think it wasn't, there was not a political thing. There was an ethnic thing that I was very aware that I was Jewish. I mean, like I was, like I said, the suburbs, like 30% Jewish, 70% not. And, you know, I definitely got, you know, called a kike. I definitely got in fights about it. Like, I, you know, like, it was like, and it wasn't like I lived in some rough and tumble place. Like, this is a suburb in the 80s. But it was like, that was, as an identity, That was a very big part. That's how I understood myself. It was like sort of first as a Jew. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if that's answering the question, well, but it wasn't like a political thing. I don't think it was, I think of it as like an ethnic thing.
Also what you're saying reminds me, like when I was a kid, you know, you learn like these, Judeo-Christian values, but the Judeo part I learned later, maybe when I was in college, that like is significantly smaller population wise. I mean, what you're saying, like 30%, is still pretty damn significant, because I mean, of the major world religions, like Judaism is by far the smallest in terms of population. I mean, I had heard that as a kid, someone said something like, you know, there are more Jewish people in Brooklyn than in like Israel. And I don't know if that's exactly
true, but it's close, but it's, yeah.
But in the US, yeah, there's, for sure.
Yeah.
So it's still a minority group. Like it's a very much a minority group.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, that's one of the things that sort of, you know, perspectively for me, always interesting to think about, because yeah, the US, I think the Jewish population is something like 2%, and in the world, the Jewish population is 0.02%, right? There's like 14 million Jews in the world or so. Yeah. And like, so it's like, yeah, I think there's more Jains than there are Jews. And like, I think, like, I'm serious. Like, I think like,
that's quite a sentence.
Yeah. I could be wrong about that.
J-A-I-N. I mean, it's very small. Yeah. Compared to like a billion Muslims and a billion.
Oh, I thought you meant people named Jane. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there's I think over a billion Muslims and over a billion Christians at this point. I don't know how many Buddhists, but yeah, it's really tiny. So yeah, so the one place I am is like one of, you know, four places in the world that has anything like a substantial population of Jews.
Right, yeah, like a community.
Yeah.
So with this being your first novel, you're clearly working through like some, you know, history and some like stuff that you grew up with and things that were part of your like identity formation as a kid. What sort of, like, where was the impetus for the idea of the instructions to be like, this is my first foray into like serious fiction? Because this was your MFA thesis, is that right?
It was. The first, I think I turned in like a slightly lesser version of the first like 300 pages or so, where it was.
Okay.
But I mean, the impetus, I mean, I guess it's like, you know, all things I write, really, I just started writing and then I kind of discovered what it was going to be. So I know that's a really boring answer. I mean, the more interesting and I think just as true answer is probably that, like, I did when I was a kid, I really did think like it's possible I'm the Messiah. Right. So like I thought about that. Like, I didn't think that when I was writing the book, but I was also aware that other kids thought that, because we were told that, right? Like, that one of the reasons you're supposed to be good is because if you act the right way and you're this one person who's, you know, around once every generation, you could actually become this, you could save the world, right?
Yeah.
It's a very, very nice notion to have as a kid. It also makes you act weird and think a little weird maybe sometimes. But like that was a possibility. Like, I think I gave that a lot of thought and consideration when I was young. And, you know, I'm like, then, and I thought about that later, how weird that was, like when I was even just a little bit older. But, and like, had I been as intelligent as my protagonist or as tough as him, you know, who knows what would have been. Like, if I could have, if I would have felt basically capable of justifying anything I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly.
It would have been a fucking nightmare, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Sure. I mean, maybe it's not your next book, but your next novel that was published after this was Bubblegum, right? And
it's
also a younger character. I mean, do you feel like you have any particular interest with childhood, or, you know, looking back and remembering what that would be like as a way of writing fiction? Like, or maybe another question there is, whether any parts of your other works that you pulled out of this while you were writing this that became something else?
while I was writing the instructions.
Yeah, does that make sense? Like, did you say like, oh, there's a bit of bubble gum and I'm going to pull that out and do something with it later?
Yeah, I don't think that I did, though. I think mostly, like, when I'm, if you guys saw what my, like, Microsoft Word files look like, it's like, I have, like, if I change a comma some days, if I'm feeling uptight, it gets, like, a new number on the front of the name of it. It's like, so it's like, I have folders full of, like, very slightly varied things, and so I don't think I've ever done that thing where, I mean, I won't say ever. There's probably an exception. With stories, it was surely the case. But with the novels, I think they were all really, like, from scratch. Like, Bubblegum, I went at actually just being like, I want this to be very unlike the instructions, like, on a formal level. Mm-hmm. And I think I was thinking, you know, obviously about the, you know, the conceit in Bubblegum is very different than that in the instructions, but it's a wild conceit or whatever, that there's going to be, there's no internet and there's these things, these curios, yeah. Like, yeah, that's like, that's sort of wild the way I guess, like, a kid who might be the Messiah is wild, but also very different thematically. So yeah. It's like, I don't think there was, I understand why you're asking that though, I think, Matt, because there is some pretty intense childhood stuff in Bubblegum. But yeah, I none of it came from the instructions.
So you just start on like page one and you're like, tomorrow, page two, and the next day, page three, and like, just
see what develops.
Like, I can't relate to this at all, man. Like, what you're describing just sounds like fucking insane to me. Like, you're not like using cut and paste or like the find feature and deleting shit and putting it in a random document. You're just like, well, I'm just going to do chapter 12 next. Like,
yeah. Oh man, I wish it was that simple. Yeah, if I could write a page a day, man, Jesus, I'd have so many books. Like, yeah, I mean, I think that kind of process, when I was working on stories, that's actually how stories went. Would be like, because I'd be working on a few at a time, and I would find myself trying to use this, working on one story that has one voice. And writing about something that turned out, I was like, no, that's your head's in this other story. And that's why this, you know, and then, so then I would do a sort of transplantation and, you know, change the voice. But with a book now, like I'm pretty focused on the one thing, and anything that's getting in the way, I kind of, like I said, like I maybe have saved it in some document, but I'll never find the document. Like,
so you would sit down and say, I'm going to write a story. I'm going to write a short story. It's going to be, you know, you've already got the idea and you just start working on it. Or do you just start working on something that becomes a novel or a story?
The latter. Okay. Like, I think that there was one point at which, I think I have one or two stories like that I sort of conceived of before I started writing them, but I'm almost always just chasing sentences. Definitely with the novels. The novels have all worked that way. Huh. So,
and do you have, how close are you to getting another collection together?
Not close.
Like of short stories, you mean, Matt? Or
yeah.
Like a novel?
Yeah, yeah,
of
stories. Either. No, because, I mean, you've had a couple in the New Yorker since, right? You've had a couple in the New Yorker since your last collection, at the very least, or a few. I don't know how
definitely
many you've published, but beyond the New Yorker, I mean, is that your first place your agent wants you to go to? Is it the New Yorker with them?
Yeah, it's the first place I want to go, just the fucking New Yorker.
Well, and they have like cash money, right? Like they pay people, right? So,
yeah, they do. It looks pretty. And yeah, I like the New Yorker. Like, but no, I haven't really been working on stories. I mean, I'm working on another novel, so.
That's good news.
Yeah, thank you. That last story was, I think that was the last story I wrote. Yeah. The last two stories, the last two stories I wrote. So
before this project of doing a kind of a reissue of the instructions, did you go back and read the whole goddamn thing again? Or did you?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I was curious about that. Yeah. It was a while ago now. I was sort of nervous about this conversation because I was like, man, that was like almost 2 years ago, really. It was two summers ago. I went through and revised, like not revised it, like I didn't change anything other than I found typos and like there were like maybe a couple lines that I was like, that's tin-eared. I want to change that. Oh, but yeah, it's nothing that like altered page count. You know, it's like, yeah, tiny stuff that probably polishing. No one but me was bought. Yeah, I was real obsessive when it came out in hardcover. I went through it and made all these tiny corrections for the paperback, and so I had that, and then I basically went through it fresh this time and I incorporated that, and it was, you know, it's probably like 200 or 300 very tiny things, you know. Oh, yeah.
John Updike describes that process as like finding something old on the shelf that is kind of not tarnished with age, but your temptation is always to polish something that's been sitting on the shelf, or at least dusting it.
Yes.
And also to kind of like help your younger self. Like hopefully you're smarter and wiser now, and you know more about writing than you did when you were working on this, which, you know, it's got to seem like a long time ago, even, you know, politically. When I was going back and looking at this, I was like, you know, we're talking about first page and last page. There's a lot of like waterboarding stuff and the 9/11 stuff. And like, you know, just even, you know, Philip Roth was still alive. Like there's a lot of, you know, the world has changed. Like how much did you feel that you wanted to change stuff, or you felt affinity for your younger self, or, you know, how did you feel about looking back at it?
I mean, I think I was pretty... I was happier with it than I was afraid I would. Like, I was afraid I wouldn't be happy.
Yeah, okay.
Like, of course, you know. I hadn't read it in, you know, 10 or 11 years or whatever at that time. And, no, I was good with it. There was stuff, of course, where I was like, you know, maybe I would do this differently, this line or something. But the basic movement of the book, the characterological stuff, I think it was 99.9% good with that. I mean, like, that book, one of the reasons it took me so long is because I'm so tight about that. Like, I'm okay at future-proofing things from my own point of view, at least. Like, being like, you might think this is douchey in 10 years, so maybe don't do it right now. You know, like, that's in my head a bit. I think it certainly was with the instructions, because it was the first one. And, you know, it was more like when I went back this time, It felt kind of like this obligation, because I was like, I'm not going to revise this thing again. Like I'm a tight ass. I get bothered by things like typos and dropped words. And I was like, I should just go find those and fix them. Like, you know, I'll be able to see them in a way I wasn't able to last time, because I don't have the book basically memorized anymore. So, you know.
Well, and the pleasure for me, I mean, of going back as, you know, I bought this book when it came out before we'd ever spoken or emailed or anything. And, you know, it was a sensation because of the comparison to Wallace and McSweeney's 1,000-page novel and all of this. But going back and looking at it, you know, even before we talked to you last time or before this time for sure, like, I forget just how pleasurable it is to spend time with Gurry and Maccabee, right? And like,
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm speaking for Dave here, but I found him just to be so like, kind of delightfully, I don't know, weird, but like precocious. There's a lot of like younger kid characters I don't like. You know, I would like say that star. Like, well, I'm not going to name names, but like just...
He's a great character, but he's a dick. Like,
I'm saying from other books. No, from other writers. Other books.
Okay, gotcha.
And like, you know, there's some writers who I like who have written books about, let's say, 12 to 13-year-old kids, and I'm just like, no fucking interest, right? Mm. And it's a very delicate thing to pull off. And for people who haven't read the book, I mean, I would say that is part of the appeal, is spending time with these kids who are... especially Gurion is like very bright, but not like unreasonably, they're still kids, right? Like how did you, hopefully, you know, when you were working on it, how did you think of that balance?
I mean, the way I thought about it when I was working on it was Gurion is going to be like the smartest possible kid, but he's going to be emotionally his age.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so it's like, and he's going to also know kind of that distinction. Like he's like that there is a difference between sort of emotional intelligence and, you know, intellectual intelligence or what have you. So he's like, he's good at thinking, but he's also good at deceiving himself because he, he's got a lot of feels.
Yeah.
So,
and he's hyper-romantic too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like unreasonably more than like someone in their 20s would be. Or, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's like, he's a kid. Yeah, yeah. I think he's like, and that's like, to me, like, that's also where the sort of, where his capacity for believing in Torah comes from is like, he, you know, this sort of extreme, you know, when you're a kid, your emotions are just, I don't know, but I shouldn't say yours, but mine, I mean, we're out of fucking control, man. I mean, like, you know, like, it's just like the world's consistently happening to you and you're reacting very powerfully. And, yeah. You know, I'm just cold as an adult comparatively.
Yeah, the teenage brain is like chemically bonkers.
Yeah, yeah.
So take us back to when the book first came out. You know, what was sort of your hope for it then? And like, how do you think about, you know, you've come out with two books since then, or two novels, I should say, since then, and another book of stories. So, I mean, just like a kid, I'm sure that you have matured as a person in some ways. But as a first-time author, like dropping this, we didn't have the pleasure of interviewing you back then. So, like, what was it like to, you know, get those comparisons or get, you know, good reviews? Were you sort of like nervous or excited? Like, what was your state of mind back then?
I would say nervous and excited are probably a couple of good words, but like more on the excited side, like, because I felt really confident about the book, which sounds, you know, sort of douchey, but I did. Like, I'd worked on it forever. I'd shown it to people who I trusted, who would tell me when something I did was fucked up. And like, I got to the, I was like, I've impressed these people at this point. And it was, and by then, like I said, you know, like it was really 9 years of working on it. And I know that I did everything I could to make it as good as it could be. And so I felt pretty solid about it. And I'm also like, I'm not like the most humble guy on earth. So it's like, I was like, you know, I couldn't tell, like, no, I was just like, you know, like, I did this. Like, this was like, I spent a third of my life writing this
thing. Yeah.
You know, at that time.
And like, George Saunders told me it was great. So yeah, it's, I mean, reasonable to assume that, like, you're fine, sir. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I'm not going to embarrass myself. And like, I know it's not a good look to say that stuff, but it's, but that is, yeah, that's how I felt. And like, I felt pretty good about it. And I, like, to the point that, you know, there were some really nice reviews and some really nice things said. And that when shitty things were said, I was like, this person's obviously an asshole, or they have an axe to grind, or they lack taste. You know, it wasn't, yeah. it was not, you know. So, yeah, I felt like, that said, I was, I don't want to, I hate this, the word has been so overused, but I was also extremely grateful. Like, I feel like I got really lucky. And at the time, I did realize I was pretty lucky, but I didn't realize, you know, how lucky that everything kind of lined up, right? Like, McSweeney's did such a killer job, like, making the physical thing, promoting it, and my editor was amazing. So it's like, I had, like, the best
Eli possible. Eli Horowitz, right?
Yeah, Eli, man. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine having a better experience. Yeah. So,
and I think, like, McSweeney's was at the height of its powers around when your book came out. Like, that was the time period where I felt like McSweeney's was, like, the shit, you know?
Yep. Yep.
It was still great, obviously, but, like, it felt like is eclipsing everything else in literature around that time. Mm-hmm.
Well, and in fact, the kind of word diagrams that are in here, for people who haven't seen the book, like, there are these kind of pieces of art using type that are diagrams of, like, the gym and the cage and stuff. And that, to me, felt very Dave Eggers, like, maybe because it's the same font that, like, Dave Eggers' books used as well. But, like, would you describe, I mean, there's some, like, postmodern stuff in the book, like, would you describe it as, like, how did it feel to you, like, you're working on something that is in the postmodern tradition, or more like, most people I think consider themselves to be realist, but then put in a bunch of postmodern shit. Like, how did you feel like the tradition that you're writing in there when you're doing stuff like that? We're like, okay, Eli, I need you to diagram out this fucking chart for me, you know, typeset this shit like completely.
Oh, I mean, I did that insanely. Myself. Like, but I mean, they obviously had to typeset, but I did all that word like very painstakingly. Oh, and like
space.
man, noodle nuts, because you know it would shift sometimes when you convert it to PDF. It was, you know, back in the old days. But no, I mean, I don't think I think that when I thought about the tradition that I was writing in, like I said, this is, you know, I just thought I was writing the tradition of books that are. The one I wanted to be writing was books that people love. Like, and so it was like, to me, like the way I had been taught and from what reading I had done by then, I had kind of decided that these other categories, like even talking about like postmodernism, there's some validity to talking about a postmodern work as a postmodern work. But like, I kind of don't believe in those categories. I think those categories are restricting. And like, and so I didn't, I hopefully have never really let myself get bound up in that. Like, there was no like, you know, Pynchon did this and so I have to do it a different way, or Salinger did this and I have to do it a different way, or Wallace, you know, it's like, the way I thought about it was, I love certain books, like love them. Like they're essential to me. And like, they changed my life. They changed the way I thought about the world.
Name a few.
Okay, so I would say pretty much all of Salinger's books, but at that time, even now, I'd say particularly Franny and Zooey, Slaughterhouse-Five, George Saunders' first couple collections at that time, My Life as a Man by Philip Roth, Operation Shylock, like the Roth canon, basically. By the time it was published, although not by the time I started it, I was really loving that book, Europeana, by Patrick Gurednik.
Yeah, I read that after you recommended it to us. That's great.
Yeah, great book. And like, I don't know. I mean, like, just that's sort of like off top, like White Noise and End Zone. End Zone a lot. I mean, I don't know. Like, I loved a lot of different books that I don't think most of them, if they had anything in common, I loved Don Quixote. Like, I think that like what they had in common, Don Quixote and Kafka aside, is that they were post-war, you know, post-World War II. Like, that's the only thing I think that encases them, really. And
you're looking there at a sentence level, like it was the sentences and the phrasing more than the sort of plot theme character stuff, or was it?
It was all of it. It was like, it broke my head. Like, I liked what I thought, like, if I had to say it again, like, you know, this is like on reflection and maybe I'm partly talking about what I like now, but I don't think so. Like, the books I named were definitely books that I loved at the time. I think what it was is that these are books that I would read and they would completely unmake sense of the world. They would like, you come out the other side and you were like, I don't fucking know anything. Like, and not because they were so encyclopedic that they gave me new knowledge. It was like they undermined my ability to believe in the stories and the bullshit that we tell ourselves, or that I tell myself, the way I explain the world. I want the world at the end, you know, when you come out the other side of my books or my stories, I want the world to appear like more complicated and more sort of, I guess to me that means wonderful than it did before. Like, I don't want a book, and what we, and that's because those are the books that I love. When I like a book that I've loved, I come out the other side of it thinking I don't know shit, like and enjoying that, like being like, this is that makes me feel alive. So I think I wanted to do that, but I think that books have, you know, have always done that. The books that I love, at least. I mean, Don Quixote is an old fucking book.
Mm-hmm. It's postmodern. I was going to say, in a way, it's postmodern, but like from the 1600s, right? Yeah.
Right. Oh, that's what I'm saying. That's why these categories are weird. Yeah, it's postmodern from the 1600s. Like, what does that mean, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's of the other books you named too, what one thing I find interesting about that, like Franny and Zoe and In Zone and let's say Civil War Land and Bad Decline, these are all like really short books. And like I see this a lot in like social media where there's sort of a cult of the long novel, and I kind of fucking hate it. And this is coming from a guy who's like whole loves podcast was about Infinite Jest, right? But I sort of like laugh at that or hate it whenever people like just post a stack of like really long, here's a whole bunch of 1,000-page novels, and it's like, well, who gives a shit if they're any good? Because there's a lot of really fucking great books that are like 120 pages.
I agree.
And like,
I agree. That's
I don't know. I feel. How did you? But I mean, now your book is lumped in with that. Like, you have one pretty short book, which is Hot Pink, but like, the other books are pretty long. Like so.
I mean, look, and I should say too, like, I left it out just because I thought it was obvious because of who I'm talking to. But like, Infinite Jest is on that list. Sure. But like, that's actually like Don Quixote aside, that's like one of the few really long books that I think I've loved. I read the shit out of that book, you know, like, but it's like, yeah, I don't right now, like the last few years, I'm reading almost like deliberately short novels because, first of all, like, I like them. like you said, like, secondly, I'm a slow-ass reader now. Like, the older I get, the slower I am. Not because I read less frequently, but because I just really do read slower.
You know, Wallace did have this thing about, like, the phallic size of a book, like, imposing one's phallus upon the world. And he's like, if that was, he said something like, if that's what was going on, it was operating at a level of which I do not want access to in my own brain. but anyways, we're going to transition now to a different topic. I'll let Dave go.
Yeah. So Adam, maybe walk us through a little bit more of like how this new edition came to exist. It's got a new introduction by one of your former students, Gabriel Bump, which is a really, really lovely piece of writing. Like, we were talking earlier about like your young self as a writer. And then from this intro, he kind of like maps out how you were his one of his creative writing professors and like really put him on a path as a writer, and the smoke breaks that you would have together, you know, between workshop sessions were like incredibly formative for him. And so like you are now kind of like the wise old fish, you know, imparting creative writing wisdom to like the new generation of writers. Tell us a bit more about like your relationship with Gabe and maybe some other students that have expressed similar things to you over the years.
Yeah, I mean, that intro is like next level sweet.
Yeah.
And you know, Gabe was, I had Gabe in a bunch of workshops. I had like at the Art Institute, I was teaching there for a few years, and these undergrads, I had this undergrad workshop, this advanced fiction workshop. And it was like, after like a couple semesters, there were like sort of like five or six kind of like hardcores that just took my workshop like every semester. And it was, and he was one of them. And I had a few others, all those five or six, they were like, that was like the best sort of teaching experience really that I can imagine. Because they all kept, first of all, there's this exciting thing where they're getting better at this kind of insane rate. Like, and you could see like, it's a direct result of their willingness to read what you ask them to read. And like, that was what was cool about them. These are like kids that like just loved fucking books. And like, I was mostly teaching stories, you know, but I would recommend novels. Like, and we would teach, and I would teach stories in class, but I would, you know, there'd be these novel recommendations, and these students were always like on top of it. Like, they read this stuff like instantly. And then like, it was really like really quickly, you just be like, wow, like they went from not knowing that it's even okay to do something funny to being hilarious, right? They went from not realizing that it wasn't cheesy to, you know, make something happen to like making, you know, like some like involved, you know, emotional plot thing happen. And like, and in the meantime, just getting just better and better as sentence writers at this really high rate. So Gabe was one of them. And, you know, he's such a great writer. And so So yeah, that's how he came to do the intro. Was like, they asked me, you know, is there anyone you want to do an intro? And I was like, you know, there's all sorts of people you know that it would be cool. Like, I have writer friends, and I have, you know, it's like, but it's a lot to ask someone to, you know, read, you know, a book. And I think Gabe, I was just like, that makes a certain amount of sense. And he's just sort of like coming, you know, his career is just starting, and like, and he's sharp as a tack, man. Like, he's smarter about books than I am. So I was like, you know, and I knew he liked my books. So I was like, maybe he'd want to do this. And so I said, ask Gabe, and they asked him, and he was on it, and he wrote me this beautiful thing. So yeah.
Yeah, it's really lovely. It's very flattering.
I had more trauma to describe. Yeah, but yeah, it was a really nice thing. Yeah.
Cool. Do you have a copy of the new version, the Bar Mitzvah version, yourself yet?
No,
not quite yet.
No. Okay.
So let's talk about it like as an art object, maybe like just from like the digital shots that we've seen online so far. But yeah. Like, so it's got a new cover. It's got, well, like two new covers, I guess you could say, because each. Broken yep. into two halves. Each one has its own cover.
It does.
Can you tell us anything about like the art process? Who the artist
sure.
is?
It was pretty long. And like, I should say too, that like the cool thing, and I'm glad, like I didn't ask them to do this, but like, I was really glad that they're doing it this way. But what they've posted so far, to my mind, the best parts of the covers are like the back of the covers. Mm-hmm. And so they haven't posted those. So it's kind of cool. Like, I feel like someone will get the book and they'll see the backs and they'll be like, whoa. Because the way it works, like, it was originally pitched as like that we were looking at like Diego Rivera murals. Okay. Oh, yeah. Like, have you ever seen those like Diego Rivera murals that are like these sort of six panel things, and they incorporate like these varying timelines, like sort of right on top of each other. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the idea. And there were all these different aspects of the novel, all these things that take place in the book, and you know, different locales and different times, and it was like how to blend these together. And the artist, Jeffrey Cam, like, he just killed it. Like, he, like, once he got this sort of style down, like we were just talking about, it was and this was mediated also by Justin Carter, who I'm not sure he's at McSweeney's anymore at that, but he's this really talented, he was art directing it, I guess. Mm. And so it would be like, I'd have these conferences with Justin. It was the Diego Rivera mural was one of his proposals. Mm. I thought it killed, and like, so let's go with that. And then it was just this sort of back and forth over a period of a few months, really, where like Jeffrey Cam did like a lot of different sort of mock-ups. We finally landed on one, and like landed on how to wed them, like sort of, again, looking at these specific Diego Rivera murals, and being like, this is how Rivera moves things around, and how you keep, you know, X and Y on the same plane, even though they're very different. Like, it was really fun. So I think, you know, it doesn't, in one sense, it doesn't look anything like a Rivera mural. In terms of line and stuff, it's not like a Rivera mural at all. But the spirit of it is really that. Hmm. And I love that stuff.
That's
so
cool.
So it was a real fun process. Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
So for people who haven't seen the images yet, one of them is like presumably Gurion up in a tree, kind of like pointing down to a group of kids below, like presumably giving scripture. And there's like kind of this like Shekinah glory of sunlight coming through dark clouds, like where he's standing. There's also like people eating food at a table. There's also some kids like in the cage with We Damage We on the wall, and Slocum Dies Friday on the wall in graffiti, and then a woman like plucking a chicken or something. And like, yeah. In like a very kind of like fun cartoony style. Tell me, like, how did those three or four different scenes sort of blend together? What was the behind the choices there? Did you have any part of that, or was that just like the artist like randomly?
Yeah, I mean, I named a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. That I wanted in there, with the help of Camille, like, mm-hmm. and like, where it's like, what would be a cool thing to show? Like, what would read well visually?
Yeah.
But then in terms of deciding where anything was going to be placed, I think the only thing that I really said was that I thought that the Gurion in the tree should be probably the first, but it was more like Jeffrey started doing it, and I was like, okay, this the sort of dominant part of any of the images, like which book it should be on, mm-hmm. that was sort of my, you know, say like that. That's and but otherwise it was he was just making things work. Mm-hmm. He was just like, this looks good here. This looks good, you know. So it was really
cool.
Let me ask you: there's not a lot of writers get this reissue treatment, right? Like this is it's a pretty cool achievement. And you've achieved a lot in your career. Like you have a different publisher now. You've published with some other presses. You've gotten a lot of attention. Is there anything like what's left? What's your ambition? What do you want to do next? Like what gets you up in the morning to try to do with what's left of your time here on this planet?
I want to write a short novel.
Good luck.
Under 200 pages, under
230 pages. That's serious. Yeah, like really, I want to write a really short novel. And but it's not just that. It's like, because I actually really don't think of it like, and I really appreciate you saying that stuff about achievement and all that stuff. And like, I do feel like I've been really lucky career-wise. But like, I write every day. I have since I was 17. And like, I don't see myself stopping doing that. Like, I feel like I'd go crazy if I stopped doing that. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, I get still pretty psyched to write every day, really psyched a lot of days. Mm-hmm. So that's just, I hope I can keep on doing that. I don't see any reason why I wouldn't be able to. I did it unpaid for, you know, most of the time I've been doing it. So it's, you know.
Like you don't need $1 million to do nothing, that kind of line?
Yeah, I would take them. yeah, exactly. Like I just, yeah, I mean, there's obviously like anyone, I think I would love to not have to have a job and just write, but like, I'm not like, that's what I'm going for. That's like my goal. Like,
wait, do you have a job? I thought you were one of those who didn't.
Like, no, I have a job.
Oh, shit. Is that why you moved
I didn't
back?
Have a job.
Are you teaching these days? Are you back teaching again?
No. I'm doing something else.
let me ask you, do you do other kinds of writing? Like, do you keep a journal? Do you put a lot of time into correspondence? Like, or is your time in front of the writing machine basically 100% fiction?
I'd say it's 95% fiction. I mean, I definitely will email with folks, like, but I don't keep a journal. I mean, the only, like, if I'm away, if I'm traveling, or if I'm like, for whatever reason, like stuck or like in a, just feeling angry or at something I'm working on, and sometimes I'll write in a notebook, but it's still fiction. I get zero interest in like recording my life.
For posterity, for your future biographer.
Yeah. I'm starting to feel like maybe, you know, this is like, I've been a little too hardcore about that. Like not in terms of the writing, but like, I don't take photos either. Mm-hmm. Like, and now I'm sort of like, sometimes I'll see photos. I'm very unsentimental, I think. Mm. Like, and I'm becoming more and more sentimental because I'll see photos of like, you know, me and my wife or something from 10 years ago. Mm. And I'll be like, shit, I wish I had more of those.
Yeah.
Like, but it's really the first time, like I'm not, you know, I don't get all melty usually over stuff. So, so maybe I'll feel that way about writing and wish I'd kept a journal or something, but I kind of don't think so. I think I look at my old fiction and it does that for me. I think
I mean, that kind of answers another question I had for you, which was about separating your kind of life from your work. And, you know, there's a big trend obviously in contemporary publishing towards like auto fiction. And I want to know what you think of that, or have you read any of it that you do like?
Sure.
You know, how do you make sense of it?
Well, I mean, again, it's sort of like, it's like an even lesser version in a way, like autofiction, of calling something like postmodern. Like there's stuff that's called autofiction that I just love. Like Autoportrait by Edouard Levet is one of my favorite books.
And the Jesse
like,
Ball,
I love this.
Have you heard the Jesse Ball version of
he recommended that to us like three times ago when you were on. Two times.
Yeah. Three. He's, yeah. That's awesome. So I have
love that book. That's great.
Yeah. I'm not ever going to read something because it's autofiction, and I'm not ever going to not read something because it's autofiction. Like, I don't care. Like it's like, I guess I don't really have a strong opinion on it other than it seems to me like people talk about it, a bit like, it seems like one is supposed to have a stance, and that's always a bad sign for me. Like, I don't know.
Well,
you know,
I think the question is more about, like, incorporating your life into your work. And, like, I wonder, you know, even what's called autofiction, is it really just thinly veiled stories? Like, you change a few names and then it's fiction, right? Or, you know, you've taught kids, I'm sure, that, you know, they get conflicting advice. Like, on the one hand, you should, you know, write stuff, you know, write stuff, you know, on the other hand, you shouldn't, like, you know, every 22-year-old story is about going to grad school. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
No, I'm with you, man. Like, I think, I guess to me, the way I look at it is that everything's fiction. So it's like, I look at memoir as fiction. Like, the memoirs I like, it's because I'm able to pretend that they're fiction. Like, I really like reading memoir by Mary Carr. Like, there's very few memoirs I really like to read, but she's a stellar writer. And so when I read the Mary Carr stuff, I'm like, yeah, I can pretend this is a novel. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't, because I don't really want to sit down and read about someone's actual life. Like, if it, you know, that's not what I go to fiction for. There's nothing, not that there's anything wrong with that. It's not like cyber, but like, but no, I don't think there's anything like wrong or debased or degraded about reading memoir at all. Like, or writing it. I'm just not interested in it.
Right.
As a general rule. And so with autofiction, I guess, like, one thing I could say, like, hypothetically, it's like, if I were reading a work of autofiction and it relied on me believing, that it was, I don't know, that it was true, would you? Like, I just wouldn't want to read it.
Like, that's insane. Like, you don't want to even have that kind of constraint to say, you know, I'm with you. I think there's also a lot of fictionalizing in anything anyone writes. And I don't really trust any memoir to be like, I wouldn't want it to be like, oh, this is 100% factual and what's true. You know, like, what's real versus what's true. I mean, I've read some, like, books of letters. Like, I love, like, people's correspondence. And, like, to me, if it's a good writer, it reads like a fucking novel. Like, Patricia Highsmith's letters, or, you know, you read this book of Susan Sontag's diaries, and it's just like, man, she's just a fucking amazing writer. I don't even know how you categorize it. Like, maybe it's a problem of categorization, you know, that you were saying earlier. Like, who cares about the label on it? Like, I don't know.
I mean, it's like the only, like, I guess, yeah, to me, it's the measure is, like, if I have to pretend like what I'm reading is gospel or something, like, I just don't do it. Like, if you tell me that someone hands me a memoir, I'm like, my bullshit detector just goes on. Like, I'm just like, yeah, really? Like, that's what it felt like, you know, like that's what the clouds looked like that day.
Okay.
Fuck you. And it's like, so, but if it's well written enough, then I pretend it's a novel. Right. And I'm just like, okay, cool. Like, you know? So if the reality of it, if at the end of it, I have to go, you know, and then she became a writer and wrote this memoir.
Like, that's how I became a writer, right?
Yeah. That's not what I want.
Right.
So,
of the theme of everything you're saying, you know, it feels like to me a big theme of it is part of it is the format of the book. And like what we've been talking about is a book that is a physical thing, and whether it's 1,000 pages or whether it has the word memoir printed on the back, like, to me, what matters is, like, you can pick it up and examine it for yourself. And it's a very, like, personal, private experience. And I think, I see a lot of people reading on their phones, and it drives me fucking crazy. Like, I just have a personal, like, pet peeve of, like, you go to a reading and, like, someone's reading a poem off their phone, and, like, it makes me just want to, like, I don't even want to participate in that. You know, like, I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
Like, it's like bad luck or something for me.
I find that irksome as well.
But I just don't also, like,
it makes me sad.
I think what I'm, you know, it feels like that is an important piece, especially when we're talking about the instructions. Like, if you just sent me the Word file, I don't know that I would give as much of a shit about scrolling through a long Word file. You know what I mean?
But
if you print, print the fucking book, and then I'm there. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you, but, you know, at the same time, like, I do think that's probably, it probably just comes, I mean, like, so many things, like, just to personal taste, right? Because I have, like, I get a lot, more and more, I get fan mail from people who, like, have listened to my books, which to me was this, like, very foreign idea, and, like, But I mean, they'll say smart things. They understood my book. So I'm like, okay, this just isn't my style. I want, yeah, I want the object.
Yeah.
I never listen to audiobooks. Maybe like one in my whole life.
I'm not opposed to
like nonfiction. Yeah, I'm not opposed to any of it. I'm not even the phone thing, but it's like you said, it makes me sad for some reason that sort of, I think it's just, it's like, it's almost, I don't know if it's some kind of nostalgia thing or just that it's like, I like books, like I like them the same way I like, you know, I like paintings, like I like physical things. Yeah, I don't know, and I kind of don't like screens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like it's the older I get, the less I like screens. So
unless they're like a video game screen or something.
But even that's what I'm saying, man. It's like, and I play games, and it's like, but man, like I walk away from like playing video games feeling like a little dizzy lately. Okay. Like, you know, yeah, like,
that's changing.
Like a book is like this anchor. It's like real stabilizing.
Yeah.
But it, that's, you know,
well, the phone is killing it all. And I mean, I have a friend who works in the video game industry, and like, there's a huge decline in even people buying consoles or using console games.
Yeah.
And that the tendency is now just for
free to play
And it's mostly even people who play any kind of game is sort of competing with people who just scroll mindlessly on their phone through Twitter, yep, or TikTok or Instagram. And that I feel very acutely, partly because I have two teenagers in the house, and like also for myself, like it is a continual battle to like put the fucking phone down and pick up a book. And it does make me feel sad for myself and the world. Like if everything just gets flattened into a screen rather than in these, you know, rectangles we keep on our shelves. So
I agree, man. But you know, at the same time, it's like, yeah, I don't know, like to me it's like the phone, I don't have any games on my phone. I did, like when I first got an iPhone years ago, I started getting a lot of, like, I don't think there were many free to play ones. Like I would pay the buck or whatever. You know, like threes.
Yeah,
but it's like, again, it's like I find it very uncomfortable play games on the phone. Like I find, like, I don't know, like there's not, I understand it to like as a boredom killer if you're like waiting for your friend at the bar or something. Mm-hmm. But I usually find it less boring to just, you know, look at the people in the bar. I have backgammon on my phone still. I think that's the only game I got. I play backgammon all the time, you know. And like, but I would rather play backgammon in real life.
Yeah,
like
you want to roll the dice.
So
I'm gonna click those. Yeah, those roll chips, the dice, man. I swallowed a backgammon piece when I was like two and a half. Jesus. My mom took me to the hospital, and the doctor thought she was like a hysterical mother and didn't believe her. She finally like pushed hard enough, and they like did a telescopic camera down my throat, and they're like, "Oh yeah, it's in there."
How'd they bring it back?
Extracted it. Yeah, they extracted it somehow. I think. Yeah.
You don't remember?
I don't remember. I think the piece is like in my baby book though. Maybe I'll go back and see if it's a white or a black piece. I can't remember.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Adam, crazy. Speaking of like long books versus short books and like the form that a book takes, do you feel aspirational about how like the new edition of the instructions is broken into two halves? Do you think more people are going to read it and be like less intimidated to read this book because of that physical demarcation now? Like, I think the instructions is the most like intimidating book on my bookshelf. When people come over there, they're like, "Holy shit! Like, what is that? You've read that?"
Yeah,
I've read it a couple times. They're like as if, you know. So like, in half. Is it gonna make? I wonder if it's gonna make people like more inclined to read it because they feel like less fear or less a wall or barrier or something.
I mean, that would be nice. My thought was like, I think, you know, I don't know, because I think that the size was like this sort of like blessing and curse, because I think a lot of people pick it up because it's that size. Yeah. And like the hope is that if you know, turn to page one and start reading it, you're excited enough that you keep going. But yeah, I mean, to me, like the dividing it in two, as Matt brought up right at the beginning, it sort of made sense because the book is in these sort of two larger books.
Yeah.
And also, like, honestly, this goes back to me being an old man who gets dizzy when he even looks at screens. Like it's like, it's a strain to hold that thing, man. Mm-hmm. Like when I read it for the revision, like the old one, like I actually like tore it, which is something I never do to books. Oh. Like I tore it in four,
yeah,
so that I could like hold it without straining my neck, because I have this old man back that I've had since I was a kid. And I just thought, man, it would be nice if this thing didn't weigh as much. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of it. And I think the hope with the new edition is that the cover, you know, would draw people that weren't drawn to the other cover, which I loved. Like, I love both, you know, both covers.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the it's just, great. Yeah, to me, it's just all about getting people sort of to you know, turn to page one or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because anyone who reads page one of my book and is like, I don't want to read this shit, really probably shouldn't read it.
Like, yeah, because there's more where that came from, and a lot more of it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And if they do read it and they're into it, then I think they should read it.
And like, if they read Delilio on page one, like, they're hooked, you know, for the next 500-600 pages. Yeah.
Delilio. Delilio.
On Delilio.
Oh my god.
You've got some important dates coming up here, Adam, with respect to like book launch stuff. Do you want to talk a little bit about those? Plug a few locations and times?
Sure. I'm going to do just basically three events. So I'm going to be in New York on, I don't want to get this wrong, I believe it's May 2nd at P&T Knitwear.
Yep.
And I'm going to talk to, Gabe.
Cool.
Yep. The in conversation thing. And we'll be signing books and hopefully, you know, drinks after. I mean, definitely drinks after. So that's May 2nd. And then a week later, or 8 days later, I'll be in LA on May 10th at Chevalier's Bookstore, which is out of Larchmont. And I think that's going to be just me. And same thing, do, you know, reading, signing, Q&A. Do reading, signing, Q&A at any of these. And and drinks. And then there's going to be the Chicago launch will be last, actually. And it'll be, I think it's May 16th.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's May 16th at Exile in Bookville, which is
it's a great store.
My favorite bookstore in Chicago.
I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know Javier?
I don't know him, but I went there last fall just to like, because I was at the museum across the street. And
At SAIC. Or at AIC.
Yeah. It's kind of on the second floor, right? Like you go in
of the fine art building. Yeah.
And
man,
it's a great fucking store. Like I could have bought everything
great
in there. Highly recommend if you're in Chicago, check out Exile in Bookville.
It's awesome. And like they do great events. So, and that's going to be like pretty much a party. Like that's going to be like, we'll do, you know, there'll be like a pretty short reading. And of course I'll sign books and stuff, but that's going to be like, yeah,
it's a little weird. I love that thing. You're in Chicago, but Tabordo's moved. Kyle Beachy has moved.
Oh, right, he's in like New York, right?
It's like you were all in far-flung places. You got to get Tabordo back out there somehow, man. Mm.
I know, man. I know. I think he might come this summer because he's got, you know, they're putting out a sort of omnibus of his first couple books and then a third one. So I think that's going to be later this summer. I don't know the date.
We'll have him on to promote that. Don't worry about it. So
You should. He's the best.
Adam, can we share the friends and family discount code if people want to pre-order the new edition through McSweeney's?
Sure.
Can we consider our listeners friends?
I think so. Yeah. I didn't have permission, but you know, I'm gonna go ahead and say yeah.
Yeah, we can cut this in post production if it turns out that was a little too wide of a share, but there's a 25% off discount code if you pre-order through the McSweeney's site, and it's Mazel Tov.
Yes.
Nice.
Oh, and let me say one more thing about the events.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, the book release is May 21st. The events are before the release, but there will be copies at all the events.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's just like something
before
screwy happened.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, before street date. Nice. So yeah. So that's a thing people should know.
Nice. What's your experience been like doing book signings and talking to people who come up? Like, do you find that you get a lot of sort of punishers who just want to like talk about their own writing and like get like, it's been generally positive?
In fact, it's been really positive. Cool. Like, you know, people talk about that. Like, I have lovely readers. Like I'm not just saying that like in an ass kissy way. Like I really like, I feel like I tend to have, we have these interactions. I talk to them. Sometimes we're drinking after whatever, but yeah, no, I don't get this sense, you know, once in a while people come up and they want something from you,
yeah.
But usually like, it's not that, it's like they read my book, or, you know, they're about to, and they're interested. That's why they came out. They came to a reading, and the vibe is great. Like,
yeah, that's cool.
I haven't had much of that. Like, I remember, I don't know if that went out of style or if I'm just lucky, because like, I feel like when I was in grad school, I'd go to all these readings and you know, you would see people like sort of like ask some question that was really
more of a comment,
an opportunity for them to promote themselves or something.
Yeah.
You know, or within my, you know, like, and that's not, I find that people, at least my people, are not like that. They're really cool.
Yeah, so, I have also experienced that exact thing that you just talked about with people who also like your books. So when I discover someone who's also read the instructions, I immediately like them a lot, and we have good things to talk about, and the rapport is like, is great. Yep,
you know? That makes me very happy.
You do have good readers, yeah.
Well, my question was more of like, do you get tired of people like us asking you the same old questions at every event?
No, because I just make the shit up as I go along. So it's like, I think like, you know, I my question is, do people get tired of me accidentally repeating myself once in a while? Because I'm basically lying the whole time about everything but the date with the book. It's off the top of my head. That's like, good. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking That's about. Funny. I don't remember writing the book, you know? So it's, no, I'm kidding, sort of.
Is that what teaching felt like for you a little bit too, doing workshops? You're just like, I'm just going to riff here and make shit up?
There was a lot of riffing workshop, but no. See, I was pretty diehard. Was like, I think this is like in great contrast to teaching, really. Mm-hmm. I think with teaching, like, I would really read the student stuff like two or three times, mm-hmm. and like have like tons of notes. And it was probably too much a lot of times. But I wanted to, you know, because I had such great teachers that I was like, this can actually be done really well. Because I've also had really shitty work teachers, you know, like I think anyone who's been at workshops, some of them have been lucky enough to have good teachers. Most of them, if not all of them, have had bad teachers at some point. And that's lame. Like, that's, you know, so I never wanted to be that guy. Yeah. So, yeah. But, yeah, there was a lot of babbling, I guess. I babbled, as you know.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a high school teacher. I know about that.
Any final thoughts before we let you go?
Final thoughts. No, it was really great coming on, guys. It's like, it's always great talking to you. I love your podcast. And,
oh, thanks, man.
No. And also, yeah, no, I mean, one final thought, man. I think I told you in an email, and it's been a while now, but I really dug the Mailing Deck, man.
Oh, that's really like, kind of you to say that.
I really enjoyed that book, really, man. I hope there will be another one soon.
It is great.
I'm trying to work on a bit of a sequel to it, so we'll cut this part out. But no, thanks for that. That's really kind. And if people want your books, I would say order them from an independent bookstore, right? Is that the best way?
Yeah. Oh, I would definitely say that. Yeah. Yeah. Or independent bookstore, or directly from McSweeney's.
Or directly from McSweeney's.
Don't do the bad thing.
Using the I think. Yeah, this book, I mean, especially this one, like, it was really indie bookstores really kind of made this book. They've been extremely good to me my throughout my career, and so
sweet.
Yeah, I couldn't have done it without them, and I love those places. So that's please give cool. them the money.
Sweet. All right.
Yeah.
Well, Adam, it's been surreal to have you on as usual. Like, when I first read this book in the summer of 2012, I was like, this guy is so cool. I really want to become friends with Adam Levin, but obviously like that will never happen, you know, like, and then 10 years later, like, I've had three long, excellent conversations with you. So it feels like truly like a dreamscape that this exists. So thank you so much again for coming on. It's amazing to talk to you about this book and all your books. And we hope people who haven't read the instructions now get like a new push to be like, okay, now is the time to get this new version and finally read it, because it is the shit.
Amen. Well, about the rest, I don't know if it's the shit.
It is. Can we also talk about how Cammy has a new novel coming out this summer?
Yeah. Cammy's got a book called The Material that's coming out June 11th.
June 11th, okay.
Yeah, yeah, and it's awesome.
We'll
it's,
try to get her on the show.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you should. You should.
She did agree, cool, actually. Man. So if it still works out for her, that would be cool. Yeah, I messaged her on Instagram like 6 months ago, and she first like posted like she has a novel coming out. I was like, we'd love to get you on if you want to talk. She's like, yeah, let's do it. So
yeah, that book's fire, man. Cool. Sweet. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's all fancy now. She won the Guggenheim a couple days ago.
I saw that.
I so know. Congrats to her. That's massive. Wow.
Dave Foster Wallace wrote a whole story about not getting the Guggenheim.
Not winning the Guggenheim. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
She fucking hated
that. It's a funny complaint from a guy who got the genius grant.
Like, yeah, totally.
Butt hurt over. He applied like 3 times for Guggenheim and never got it. And so.
Oh, yeah. Everyone applies like a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, is my understanding. I had a teacher who will remain unnamed in grad school and she won. And I was like, congratulations. Like that's amazing. She was like, it's the 16th time I applied. Like, why don't you just like, it's whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's cool.
Dave, where can people find us?
Oh, yeah, we are kinkcavityshow@gmail.com. If you want to email us, send us any thoughts, suggestions about what you want to hear on the show, people you want to hear us talk to, books we should be checking out. We love that stuff from our listeners. We're Kinkcavity Show on Instagram and Twitter. I haven't touched Facebook in like years for the show, so forget about that. Those are the places.
Patreon.
Oh yeah, we have Patreon. Oh, mm-hmm. Threadless merch. If you want to get a skateboard with Kinkcavity Show logo on, that's dope. Or like a mug or a shirt. Our stuff goes on sale like all the time there. So like watch out for $14 t-shirts and stuff. It's pretty common. That's that.
All right. Into darkness. Looks like we lost Dave. All right, let's take 5.
Take 5.
Dave's back.
All right.
We're still rolling, so still rolling. We didn't have you take a camera into the bathroom or anything, but we did record the break. So, so anyways, we were talking about short versus long. You know, short versus long, but in terms of novels.